This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:17 p.m., Thursday, January 30th, in Barnes 124, in 2025. Members present are Representative Schwanke, Mears, Gray, Prox, and myself, Rep. Mina Chair, and I believe we also have Rep. Fields. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Staffing the committee today, we have Cale Brown as Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, Zach Lawhorn as our LAO moderator, and Katie Giorgio as my committee aide. If you need anything during the meeting, please don't hesitate to get her attention. Today, we have one item on the agenda, an overview of the Department of Family and Community Services. I'd like to invite Commissioner Kim Koval, Deputy Commissioner Clinton Lasley, and Assistant Commissioner Marion Sweet to come to the presenter's table. And we also have the division directors on the line who are available for questions, including Director Scott York of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, Director Matt Davidson of the Division of Juvenile Justice, Director Kim Guay of the Office of Children's Services, and Director Heidi Hamilton of Alaska Pioneer Homes. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you are ready. At ease. Back on the record. Please continue, Commissioner Koval.
Thank you. How are we doing on sound? Good? Okay, excellent. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Kim Koval. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. Thank you for the time to present to the committee. I've been the commissioner since the creation of the department in July 1st of 2022, when the large department reorganized into two smaller departments. We've seen some really great work that our employees have achieved with this reorganization and the daily activities that we do on a daily basis for Alaskans throughout the state. As you know, I'm joined by DC Lasley, AC Sweet, and then also in the gallery, we also have Senior Policy Advisor Chrissy Vogley and Legislative Liaison Ramey Menachowski, and we also have our division directors online as well. So as a refresher for our new legislators and for those who may not be familiar with these departments, the reorganization of the Department of Health and Social Services into two departments, Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services, occurred July 1st, 2022. The reorganization aimed to create more agile organizations to better address the needs of Alaskans. And the creation of DFCS allowed for a more focused approach to delivering direct care to Alaskans, including youth, psychiatric patients, and elders, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in facilities and community settings. And because of the reorganization, DFCS has been able to more successfully collaborate with stakeholders, federal partners, and local communities to develop strategies that improve the outcomes for Alaskans. So forgive me, two of the slides are actually out of order. If that's all right, I'm going to go to this one and then flip back. This is the organizational chart for the department, and we have key positions listed here with each of the divisions and also within the commissioner's office. And as a reminder, the mission of our department is to provide support, safety, and personal well-being for vulnerable Alaskans. And we have four direct service divisions in that form the foundation of our department, which is the Alaska Pioneer Homes, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, Division of Juvenile Justice, and the Office of Children's Services. We're going to do a quick overview with the divisions here for the next few minutes. So the Alaska Pioneer Homes provides services including assistance with activities of daily living, nursing services, recreational social programs, and assistance with medications, dietary needs, housekeeping, and meal preparation. The homes provide a wide range of services and activities for the most independent to those living with dementia-related diseases and advanced complex care needs. Our residents, 61% of our residents in the Pioneer Homes have a diagnosed dementia-related disease. We have over 400 positions and a budget of just over $112 million. And as you can see from the slide, it stipulates the different locations we have and when those homes were opened. The Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or we call API, is Alaska's only state-run hospital that provides acute psychiatric care to individuals experiencing mental health crisis. There are five inpatient units with 80 beds total available to provide compassionate health care to support Alaskans. And API is also the only entity in the state that provides competency restoration treatment for individuals who have been found by the court to be incompetent to stand trial. The budget for the fiscal year of 2025 is just over $62.5 million.
Thank you. For the record, Clinton Lassley, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. I'm going to pick up on slide 7, and we will look at the Division of Juvenile Justice. The Division of Juvenile Justice follows the restorative justice model, and it's reflected in our mission, which is to hold juveniles accountable for their behaviors and promote safety and restoration to victims and communities, and assist offenders and their families in developing skills to become productive in society. DJJ has 6 facilities across the state of Alaska. And in addition, we operate 13 probation offices across the state. Oftentimes, individuals don't think about the sort of the vast scope of the work that Division of Juvenile Justice performs. And if you think about it, only about a third of the individuals we serve are within our facilities. We serve an additional about 530 youth across the state through the probation services. The Division of Juvenile Justice has 400 PCNs across the state, or 400 positions, with a budget of $67 million. The next division is the Office of Children's Services. This is our primary child welfare system for the state of Alaska, and is responsible for ensuring the safety of Alaska children, investigating reports of child abuse and neglect, and administering the state's foster care system. We operate 21 offices across the state with 600 positions, a little over 600 positions, and a budget of $205 million.
And Deputy Commissioner Lassley, before we move on, I want to see if I want to pause to see if we have any questions.
Yes.
Representative Prox, and then Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, Chair Mina. Your sign is backwards, by the way.
Oh.
Through the chair. The restorative justice model, is that available for us to learn more about somewhere?
Yeah, Representative Brox, yes, if you go to our website, go to the Department of Family and Community Services and then onto the Juvenile Justice website, there's a whole section on restorative justice.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Representative Schwanke.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. My question is about capacity. At what capacity are the Alaska Pioneer Homes in aggregate, and then also API?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Schwanke. So the total capacity for the Pioneer Homes. Let me go to the next question. I apologize. What was the next question on API?
Basically, just what the actual capacity is listed on your slides, but I was wondering, are you at capacity?
Oh, sure. So, thank you. So capacity is 80 beds, and as of today, we are at 74 admitted patients. Yesterday was 76. The number fluctuates every single day. We may have three, for example, three discharging, two entering Those numbers can fluctuate. The wait list is at 10, and anything above 70 to us is full because one section is dual beds, which means we may not be able to put patients in the room with two to the room because it may not work best for their treatment needs or safety needs. So that number can fluctuate, but we have we can range up and down every single day. And sometimes we 76, 78, sometimes 74, but as of today it was 74. And then as far as Pioneer Homes, total capacity is 506 census. As of end of December, we are at 435, so we are at 86% occupancy. And keep in mind, we're not at full occupancy because we do have some restoration work going on in some of the homes in regards to flooring, carpeting, painting the rooms, etc., and then turning of the beds.
Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Commissioner Koval. About the Pioneer Homes, just going off of Representative Schwanke's questions, it just, I guess maybe I just need a little bit more understanding. The budget seems large for 500. Just doing a little bit of work on my phone calculator, like $112 million for 506 residents is about $221,000 per resident, which, you know, compared to like OCS, I mean, there's more kids being serviced and it's a much smaller price tag. So I guess, can you just talk about why Pioneer Homes cost so much?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, thank you. Actually, I'm going to tag team with DC Leslie on this. I'll start and I'll let DC Leslie jump in. So there are a lot of higher need elders coming into our care. There are other facilities that are not under our purview, in other words, private facilities, that will have elders there that require less, I would say, care, supervision, so what we call level one and level twos. What we're seeing on our end is as folks are waiting longer on the wait list because there are only so many beds, they are also then coming in at a higher needs, and we're seeing level three, fours, and sometimes fives, which means that we do need more staffing. We have to look at what the needs are for day versus night, and then also what those programming needs are for the elders and the equipment as well. And then, if I may, I'm going to kick it over to DC Leslie.
Yeah. Thank you again for the record. Clinton Leslie, Deputy Commissioner. The other contributing factor to this is, and Representative Fields will remember this, about 4 years ago or so, we did a sort of a reconstruction of the budget, the way the budget is structured. The state of Alaska provides a payment assistance program for elders, so we accept elders regardless of their ability to pay. You're going to see about $38 million in the budget that is, in a sense, sort of duplicated. So the GF funding that was is provided for payment assistance was moved to its own component. Inside the Pioneer Homes, the Pioneer Homes component is the IA authority to draw down those funds. So we only draw down those funds if in the event that the elders need them. So you're seeing $38 million as sort of a duplicate number within the budget structure. But I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. Through the chair, so I understand it's 86% occupancy in December due to some construction happening. I guess my question is, how long are the wait lists, and are the wait lists the same at all the Pioneer Homes?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, the wait list can vary depending on the region that the elder is trying to go into the home. So some lists are longer. The Anchorage home tends to have a longer list because of the population and also the number of rooms available. It's also more transient in that home versus Juneau, for example. Juneau, we have a smaller population, and that wait list is actually a lengthier wait list of wait time, not necessarily the number of people on. So it can really vary depending on number of people, how long, and then the region that they're in.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thank you. I was just going to point out and maybe ask DC Leslie to elaborate on the fact that we need to replace the Fairbanks Pioneer Home. That structure is end of life. If we were to replace it and make the Fairbanks Pioneer Home a Veterans and Pioneer Home, like the one in Palmer, it would improve the operating budget for that home because of VA reimbursements, and didn't know if DC Lasley want to talk about that. Obviously, we have a lot of veterans in Fairbanks, but it's something to think about long-term sustainability for the homes.
Yeah, I just briefly address it. Yes, it is one of the areas that we're looking at. You know, the Fairbanks Pioneer Home is our second oldest home in the Pioneer Home system. It is in need. You know, what we always say is it doesn't meet the needs of the elders of today, right? Whenever elders first started coming into the Pioneer Homes, we always say everyone walked into the Pioneer Homes. Today, they need assistance. Some of the rooms in the Fairbanks Pioneer Home, for instance, are 100 square feet. Mm-hmm. So whenever you're trying to maneuver an elder in, you know, that needs assistance with assistance of daily living, it's very difficult to do in 100 square feet. And all of the rooms in that facility also have shared bathrooms. So, and to Representative Fields' point, one of the considerations we have thought of is when we're able to do a replacement, would it be advantageous for us to look at that model of at least even maybe a cottage model, right, where you can use one of the homes for a veteran's home, because there are some very strict restrictions on how many elders to the veteran population that needs to be in the home. So we're looking at all those options as we move forward.
Commissioner Koval, please continue.
Again, for the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner. On slide nine now, we're going to look at whenever we became our own department, one of the areas of focus that we really wanted to put some extra energy into was those individuals that are the hardest to serve, those individuals that sometimes fall through the cracks. And so we developed the complex care unit within our department. As we have continued to sort of evolve that concept, it's now being called the Coordinated Health and Complex Care Unit. It has multiple functions within it, but one of the primary functions is looking and monitoring those individuals that are in our care or come to the attention of our facilities that need additional assistance. So we work across all four of our divisions, and we're looking for those individuals so that we can better serve their complex needs. We have regular scheduled meetings every week with the Office of Children's Services, looking at some of their most complex to place individuals. We look at and have referrals coming from our various divisions. Part of the other part of that unit is to work across systems. So we're really looking at system improvement, working with Department of Health, working with our community partners, our tribes. How do we build out a system of care that's going to meet individuals' needs that are complex to place or where we've seen sort of rotate through our systems over and over again? And how can we try to build out a system that serves that? The unit is small but mighty. It has six individuals in the unit, all the way from a deputy director to individuals helping to serve the youth and adults that come to our attention, also administrative support. Within that coordinated health and complex care unit, we've also moved our designated evaluation and treatment and designated evaluation and stabilization liaison in there. About 4 or 5 years ago, we developed a position which actually tracked all individuals that were having a Title 47 or involuntarily going to be committed to a facility. And that position tracks every one of those individuals in daily contact with our hospitals across the state and ensuring that we're getting that individual to the care that they need in a very timely manner. And then the last piece of this coordinated unit is whenever we did the split of the departments and became Department of Family and Community Services, we took over the management of the DSH agreements, the disproportionate share hospital agreements, this pays for individuals in care that are under-resourced. And so we manage those agreements, and we have a position that provides that.
I have a question for Deputy Commissioner Lasley. So, I've been really, really glad to see the progress on the Coordinated Health and Complex Care Unit. And I'm curious, with the six individuals working in this unit, is there an overarching plan for identifying the needs and gaps for complex care within DFCS and coordinating that with the work that those six staff are doing?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mina. One of the pieces of this body of work is we also have a complex care committee, and so that complex care committee works across with currently with directly with the Department of Health. And so that meets on a regular basis, and it's looking at those system-level improvements. How do we make system-level improvements across the continuum of care, knowing that it requires our partners over at Department of Health to help and support that? The next iteration of that is really to start bringing in more community providers. We've heard the voices of the community, and they want to be a part of this as we build out the system of care. And so that's our next iteration of how we're going to move this this committee forward.
Thank you. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I heard the deputy commissioner mention that this would apply to kids in foster care. And so I guess my question is, what are the solutions for some of those kids? And maybe it doesn't apply to the kids that I'm thinking of, but when you have a child with behavior issues who's been move to multiple therapeutic foster homes and there's not a new one available, is there a solution?
Well, I'll take the first part of this, and I can just hear the commissioner out of the corner of my ear. She's itching to answer this one too. You know, this is ongoing work and collaboration, and I think you saw the House bill and the Senate bill that was just recently introduced by the Department of Health for the complex residential home bill, I think is what it was called. And that's one of the steps in the right direction, right? We need those sort of step-down services and those to meet those unique needs of youth. As you know, every child is unique in their needs. And sometimes what is happening today is currently we're placing a child in hopes that they will be successful. And as we're building out these models, we want to build out unique specialty or unique homes that they specialize in certain behaviors and certain needs. And so, Commissioner, I'll pass over to you.
For the record, Kim Koval, through the chair, thank you, Representative Gray. Adding to what DC Lasley has explained, we have had really wonderful conversations with partners in other states and how they are looking at addressing complex care needs and how they are implementing some very unique pilot programs. And we are, in fact, working on several projects to do that as well. This does require a lot of help with our partners at Health, and it also requires a tremendous amount of collaboration with the private sector. We are not the deliverer of those services. We rely on our partners to deliver those services, and every business model is different. Every child is different, and therapeutic models are needing to adjust to some of our very unique needs here as well. But I am really pleased to say that we do have really tremendous communication and collaboration across the board with our agencies and our partners. And I'm hopeful that as we're examining these two pilots that that we're going to have some really good results and some information to share as we're going into the next fiscal year.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner for the Department. That's a perfect segue, Representative Gray. As we look at this slide, this slide gives a sort of a depiction of our person-centered care model that we do and the complexity of dealing with individuals with varying needs. And so you'll see that at the center of this is always the person, the individual, and their family. And all of our departments, all of our divisions across the department, each one of those individuals that we're serving is unique in their needs, and it touches so many different entities, agencies, and partners across the state of Alaska, whether it be public safety, the court system, public assistance, Medicaid. So we're working across the systems and with our community partners, as the commissioner just mentioned, to ensure that we're meeting the needs of these individuals and getting them the care that they need in a timely manner.
For the record, Kim Koval. We're now going to go into our fundamental guiding principles, and then we're going to be talking about some achievements and some future opportunities within this framework. So we have what we jokingly call SPAM, and this is our vision of service first. So we strengthen lives through meaningful connection with families, communities, tribes, and providers, providing safe, person-centered care with integrity and dignity to the Alaskans we serve, advancing an agency culture that prioritizes the well-being of our workforce, and mobilizing innovative solutions to complex challenges. So some of the examples of strengthening lives is we have been continuously building relationships with our different communities, including our tribal partners, nonprofits, and advocacy organizations. There are daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly meetings at all times, and this includes all forms of leadership. It's very important that our partners know that from entry level up to the commissioner's office, that they have access to us and that they're where to listen and find solutions to some of the challenges that they're bringing forward to us as well. For example, DJJ has a partnership with Cook Inlet Tribal Council and the Alaska Native Justice Coalition to support Alaska Native cultural programming and treatment planning for youth receiving secure treatment services in DJJ facilities. Another example is that we have a longstanding partnership with Rural Alaska Community Action Program to promote positive youth development through their resource basket toolkit. And this supports juvenile reentry, peer education, restorative practices, and grant management to Alaska Native tribes. API has collaborated with Alaska Native Medical Center to provide culture-appropriate meals for our patients. Both DJJ and Pioneer Homes, our youth are out hunting and fishing with staff. In fact, it's one of the highlights at the Bethel Youth Facility when they get to go out and hunt moose and fish. And we gift that game meat and fish to our different facilities and receive it and do preparations with the youth. And it's one of the best things ever. And another example is that we host so many family nights. We invite families to come in to be a part of the process. And we always reflect the different cultures that we are experiencing in our facilities as well. In regards to providing safe, person-centered care, we've been developing adaptable service models that can be customized to meet diverse needs of families and communities, establishing those relationships among our divisions that strengthen us and allow us to address the needs. Quite frankly, our four divisions are able to collaborate much quicker, faster, and we're able to be more nimble with our decision-making. We collaborate with our sister agencies in the departments, health, corrections, public safety, admin, labor, and education. And, for example, we have been able to look at person-centered care through our traumatic brain injury screening for youth at DJJ. And then we're also looking at evidence-based practices that we're utilizing, like parents as teachers and early childhood mental health systems of care.
Thank you again for the record, Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner. As I was talking about earlier, as we became a new department, one of the things that we really wanted to focus on was our people. You know, I think for these, the divisions that make up the Department of Family and Community Services, we've always done a tremendous job of serving individuals. But one of the things that we realized as the mega agency of Department of Health and Social Services is we did not have the bandwidth to really take care of the people that are serving those individuals in our settings. Just for reference, Department of Family and Community Services is the third largest department with the workforce. When we look at workforce, we have a little over 1,900 total positions across the department. The commissioner has been a great asset as she came on to the department because getting out there and meeting with the individuals that work in our offices and in our facilities across the state was essential. And so the commissioner makes the time to – she sends out kudo letters and thank you letters to the staff all of the time and thank you cards. We do town halls, and so there's town halls at various times so that we can hear from our staff across the state. The commissioner is does the red eye, so she does three per occasion, so that we're catching everyone. Because as you know, we provide services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we're wanting to make sure that we're capturing every single individual within our department, and they have an opportunity to have their voice heard and hear some updates from the department. There's pop-in visits and making sure that we're bringing food and treats to the staff and telling them how much we appreciate them, and then also doing fire fireside chat. So that like OCS does fireside chat. So they listen to the staff to hear what their needs are. They get the division director, Kim Gui, provides updates to the staff on that. We've also been engaging in employee engagement committees to really hear from the staff and find out what their needs are, doing different things to show appreciation and celebrations. We're investing heavily in training, making sure that the staff have the training that they need so that they can be successful and feel supported and appreciated. And another example of this is just providing a wellness officer within the Office of Children's Services. It's very difficult work, and making sure that we're meeting the staff where they are, and especially as they're going through some of the traumas that they face on a daily basis. When we look at innovations, one of the other functions that we've been really looking at is our turnover and making sure that we have a workforce that is there to serve the people of Alaska. Part of that is through workforce well-being. You've heard in previous hearings that we've had some of the challenges that we've faced at the Office of Children's Services and looking at those turnover rates. And it's really a great testament to the work that's happening over at the Division of Office of Children's Services. But they've taken, in the last couple of years, and taken their turnover rate from 52% down to 37%. It's trending in the right direction. We still have work to do, but they're doing a tremendous job, and I just thank them for that work. We've had some pretty significant improvements in vacancy at the Division of Juvenile Justice as we were coming out of the pandemic. And then, as you know, there's many places in the state of Alaska where we were having staffing issues. Fairbanks and Juneau were especially hit hard, but we've really been able to improve the staffing in those facilities. Part of it was we were able to get a rate increase for our juvenile justice counselors. We changed the names to juvenile justice counselors, and we've been able to improve that. The commissioner talked about our neurofeedback and neurobehavioral work that we're doing at the Division of Juvenile Justice. And then also Alaska Psychiatric Institute has been looking at ways that, you know, we only have an 80-bed capacity. So how do we serve individuals in the community better? And so we have initiated a jail-based restorations program. As you know, we have 10 beds for competency restoration at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. So we partnered with Department of Corrections in Anchorage, and we go to Department of Corrections and provide competency restoration services at the facility. We're also doing some competency restoration for misdemeanor offenders out in the community. So individuals that have been on probation or they're out on probation in the community, we provide those services.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, how often are all 10 competency beds at API full?
Every day. They're always full. We have a wait list, and that's part of the reason that we've expanded these services and have been working closely with Department of Corrections to try to get individuals into services faster.
Please continue.
The ongoing department initiatives is that we just continue to look at renovation projects that we have across the divisions. For instance, the Fairbanks Youth Facility is doing a renovation right now. We're also looking at moving. There is a request that's put into the budget this year to move some of those funds down to McLaughlin Youth Center. We have a 32-bed unit at McLaughlin Youth Center that needs some updating. We're also doing the Palmer roof replacement. That's been a little bit of a long-awaited project. We were able to get some federal funds to help and support that. That's about a $5 million project, and that is actually at 65% designed right now, getting ready to go out to bid here in a few weeks, and we'll be able to get that roof replaced. And I believe that the federal government, the Veterans Administration, is supporting that by about 60 or 65% of the cost of that project. We continue to look again at our workforce, and one of the things we've done across on a phased approach is really looked at how can we improve the recruitment process through our divisions. We were realizing it was taking us about 45 days from the time we posted a position to the time we were able to make an offer. Through the assistant commissioner shop, we have created the talent acquisition team. We were able to take those recruitment times from 45 days down to about 10 days. It's another small but mighty team, and as with any team, there's some bumps in the roads as we go through it. So we're reevaluating some of that, but we're excited to move that process forward and really try to set this as a model across departments across the state.
For the record, Kim Koval. So now we're going to talk about some future opportunities. So one of the future opportunities that we're looking at is increasing our foster home recruitment. Since the pandemic, when COVID hit, we saw a significant decrease in the number of foster homes. And prior to 2020, we had 1,456 licensed non-child-specific foster homes. In 2022, at the reorganization, we had 1,143. And today we have 920. And how we're addressing those numbers is we've established the placement and support unit in OCS. And this is, again, another small and mighty unit. And they do so much terrific work. We have recreated a new respite program because foster parents were requesting some respite. And that has just lifted off the ground. We've seen some challenges in regards to the availability of daycare accessibility for parents to consider if they want to be a foster parent because taking on more children, they need more services. The legislative body approved for the fiscal year of 25 our 30% increase foster care base rate, which is a tremendous help, and we are looking forward to having some data in regards to how that helped with our recruitment. And then we acknowledge that we do see families who want to do private placements, that they do not want to have state involvement, and we respect that. And then we also know that there are continued barriers, especially in our multi-generational families. As of July 1st, 24, though, we are very pleased to announce that 348 applicants have applied since the start of the new fiscal year. Regulation review and update. With the reorganization of the department, we cracked open the book and said, look, we got some older regulations we get to look at, and these are tens of years old. So we are right now going through those and determining what needs to have some updates. Do you need me to take a pause?
Yes. Representative Gray and then Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair to Commissioner Koval, I heard the radio ads for foster parents, I guess, in the late fall. So I was surprised when you came back with the 920 as the current number of foster homes. But you said you have 348 signed up. Those are potentially new foster care homes?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, yes, thank you. Total licensed providers is over 1,100, but 920 are the foster family homes, and
gotcha.
We have 348 applicants since July 1st. Not all of these are going to possibly pass, but they're all in different stages.
Gotcha. So follow-up. That this potentially, with these 348, we could see more. So this is really good.
I'm tickled, yes. This is great.
Follow-up. I was reached out to by a constituent who was concerned about the end of emergency placement stipend. I don't know if they were confused. I don't know if you know. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Like there was the emergency placement, folks who were getting a stipend for doing just the temporary emergency placement for the foster child who needed somewhere to go tonight, and you didn't have that more stable foster home for them to go to.
Through the chair, we do have Director Gui on the line. Would you like her to answer that?
Sure. Thank you. Okay.
Director Gui.
Yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Kim Gui. I'm the Director of Office of Children's Services. For the chair, Representative Gray, thank you for the question. We did have, in the beginning of this fiscal year, we did notice there's a little bit of a misalignment with our policy and our regulation. And so we were trying to make some correction, but we quickly paused on that correction to do a deeper dive on that. So we do currently still have emergency homes, and they are still being paid at the current rate. We are going to be working on some regulation change to try to get some alignment in the future. But that's what you were probably hearing from a constituent.
Thank you.
Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, with the foster home recruitment, we're making progress. That's good. Are we getting close to enough foster parents?
For the record, Kim Colvo, through the chair. Thank you, Rep. Prox. That's a tricky question. When is the perfect number? When is it ever enough? And there are those that will say that increasing the number reflects that we are not going in the right direction, and then those argue that having the numbers reduced shows that we are not having as much of a need. Unfortunately, those don't line up necessarily in nice and neat rows. What we're looking for is we always would like to have families of different backgrounds and cultures and ability, because not every foster home is the right fit for a particular child. Mm-hmm. And as we are seeing more siblings and we're seeing different ages, not every family is prepared to take in an infant or a toddler, and not everybody is really hip on the teenagers. So we see different families with different resources and different abilities. So for us to have a deeper bench would be the most preferable thing we'd see.
Follow up?
Would
that be worth a whole separate committee discussion? It's up to you. I don't know.
Through the chair, Rep. Prox, could you expand? What would you be looking for?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm trying to understand that whole dynamic of the right family and the right fit, and how do we get enough people that we can have some standby people and et cetera. It's a complex problem. Well, of course, all I hear is complaints anyway, but I'm trying to get a feel for the supply of foster homes and if we're doing well enough or as good as we can, or just understand that whole recruiting process and retention process better.
Through the chair, thank you, Rep. Prox. There is definitely opportunity that we could crack open that box and have a more deeper conversation with it. There are so many different pieces to the puzzle. Mm-hmm. Is it a home in what region? What community is the home in? Can the family in a multi-generational setting pass the barrier requirements that we do follow through the feds? Are there enough resources that family may need or that child may need? And quite frankly, when a foster family signs up, they sign up because they're also fostering that other family. It's not just the child. Mm-hmm. The primary goal is to reunify. And there are families that interpret reunification in different ways. So there are lots of different values in this as well. And then also families that want to become treatment foster homes is different than a regular licensed foster home. And then what are those treatments for the children? And do all the children need to be in one particular setting, or do they need different settings? And then do we have to then separate the siblings, which we don't like to do? So I would say yes with an asterisk, because that is a very deep dive. And we're happy to answer any question about it, but we're talking about a lot of different values that we're trying to honor in this process in reunification.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just comment. I'd like to help with recruiting, but I don't know what I'm doing, so I might not be any help. So if it's not worth, and that's entirely up to you, if somehow we could at least get some more training for me, that'd be great.
Through the chair, we have open positions. We're happy to have you come join in.
Sign up. That
excellent.
Would be a good idea. Actually, a lot of these functions that we oversee, it would be worthwhile to just go work there a couple of weeks and see what's going on. Yeah.
Wonderful.
There's a lot of openings, Representative Prox. Representative Ruffridge?
Thank you, Chair Mina, and thank you, Commissioner, for the work that you do. Appreciate you being here today. A couple things just on the note about foster care. Last year we had talked about increasing the base rate for foster parents. I think that did happen. Do you think that that has contributed to some of the, I guess, increased availability of foster homes? And then do you think that that rate is significant for now, or is that something that's going to be looked at to increase in the future? And then I had one other question after that.
Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Ruffridge. Yes, so it's an average of 30% across the board on the foster care base rate. It can range from anywhere from 27-28% to 32%. It just kind of depends on the categories. We do think that is part of the reason why we do see more applicants. We're hoping that it's the reason why more applicants stay or the ones that are already approved. But we don't have all of the data until we get through the year, and then we would have a better idea of exactly what the feedback is. Why did they stay on? Did they apply? Did they recruit other friends who wanted to come and do it too? So we will have better information at the close of the year.
Okay, thank you. And one other thing that we did talk about as well was the pilot program for transitional youth. Did that end up functioning, or where did that end up? And maybe that's something we can follow up on later. But that was in our future opportunities slide, I think, from last time we talked.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. So we have several pilots going on. We're looking at how we're able to transition youth. So there's a couple of ways we say transitional services. If we're talking about foster youth who are transitioning from younger age to older age and then transitioning out of foster care, we do have funds and programming that are available for the youth as they're looking at education, job training, living, daily living skills, things like that. Then we also have how are we transitioning youth from facilities back to community, and we are working on that through our complex care unit.
Okay, thank you. And then just a comment, if I may, Chair. I will say on the recruitment front, the folks in the Kenai Office of Children's Services did a fantastic job through the summer, and I know that that might be an initiative of yours and a few others to be out in the public sphere with markets and other things. They had booths and try to be a presence of this is what it looks like to interact with that department and what it might look like to invite a child in need into your home. And they did a fantastic job. My booth was right across from theirs, and I got to see them interact with a lot of people throughout the summer, and they did a great job. So props to them.
Representative Fields.
Thank you. I think this might be the right time to ask future opportunities. I was just reading this ombudsman report about DFCS and OCS from December 5th, 2014. And I was also trying to understand this report in the context of the Complex Care Initiatives Joint Annual Update. So one of the recommendations of the Ombudsman report was OCS should assign qualified staff to participate on the care response team, part of the new complex care coordination infrastructure established in 2023. And I guess I was just curious, are you all already doing this? Is this in process? I guess reading the Ombudsman report made me curious where it is.
Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Fields. So we actually had a wonderful meeting with the Ombudsman and her team in September, in the fall, at our invitation with the Department of Health, and we had a roundtable at the Strengthening Lives Conference where we basically had a conversation and educated the Ombudsman and the team in regards to all the different initiatives that we were putting in place. So the report is kind of a reflection of what we already talked about and already doing, and we acknowledged that they were going to put that recommendation in the report, even though we acknowledged we were already doing it. So it was done in coordination and collaboration with them, and it was a very positive conversation. And yes, we're already doing those things.
Could I just ask a follow-up on
follow-up?
Same topic? Okay. Thank you, through the chair. That's great. Another item in the Ombudsman's report, and maybe you all are already making progress on this, is addressing delays and getting children enrolled in Medicaid waiver services. Is there an update on that?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, yes, the different teams that work with the youth, they do help and assist and work with DPA and then the complex care team when they are assisting. If they're in the process with a complex care child, they're always looking to see, is the child already in process? And if not, if we need to do any nudging to help along with DOH, but we don't interfere. So we do partner with DOH, and we have seen good improvement there.
Okay. One more question from the Ombudsman report. That's okay. So the Ombudsman is maybe a little bit critical of OCS using funds on what they described as costly private security. And then there's a line item, I think, in the budget for armed security in Juneau, Anchorage, Wasilla, Fairbanks, and Kenai. How long have you all needed security? And if it is what we anticipate, kind of a permanent need, has there been just a comparison of whether it's more economic to have state employees versus contracting out that service?
Yeah, for the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner, Representative Fields. So we use security in a couple of different ways, but, you know, our offices, we have had many instances where there's community members that are not very pleasant to our staff and has actually either threatened or showed up at the doors of our offices. And so we're providing contracted security across most of our offices now just for the protection of our staff. I think that also helps and contributes to the staff feeling appreciated and secure. And so we've taken multiple measures, not only just with security, hiring security guards, but additional cameras, having separation, putting separation doors, so that we can sort of monitor and the egress into the facilities and offices.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up?
I'm glad you all are doing that and just wonder if this is going to be a permanent thing, which I'm guessing it is. What sort of analysis is there to make sure that we're getting the best deal by contracting out as opposed to having longer-term state employees, and what are the trade-offs between those two models?
Yeah, I mean, so we have not done that analysis. I think one of the challenges, is the liability, right? So I guess we have not looked at bringing it in-house and doing it ourselves. The way I've sort of viewed it is I would much rather us focus on the things we do great at and allowing entities that specialize in these services to be able to provide this. The other challenge with it is, you know, as I've said through some of our presentations, you know, our teams are small and mighty, but whenever you start talking about having security, and if they're just there during our office hours, if that person calls out sick, then what do you do? Whenever you use an entity or an agency, then they can provide that backup support. So there's a little bit of more bench that we can lean on to ensure that we have that security and safety at all times.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the additional background on that report.
Representative Schwanke.
Yeah, thank you through the chair. Just to keep it brief, I just wanted to say thank you for coming today and presenting this information. I think it's very important. As you know, we are facing a pretty significant fiscal crisis at this point, so I do hope that we are constantly looking to find efficiencies where we can within any of these organizations, but I will touch base with you later as we get an opportunity to meet. I'd love to find out if there are opportunities where the legislature can help support you in connecting your services with tribal entities and those coordination of care opportunities to see if we can leverage some of the resources that are available through some of our tribal health partners. So thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments from the committee? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think to the deputy commissioner, I have a question about McLaughlin. It's in my district. Is it at capacity, or how is our DOJ population of youth?
DOJ?
DJJ. Sorry. Tired. DJJ population doing in terms of do we have more than enough space? Not enough space?
So, Representative Gray, through the chair. McLaughlin Youth Facility currently stays at pretty much at full capacity at all times. We did mention earlier that we do have a unit that is currently closed down, and we've requested to move some funds that were capital funds already appropriated for Fairbanks. Just to explain a little bit more, whenever we receive the money for the Fairbanks facility, we sort of have this grand idea that we were going to do a lot of work there. It was coming in way higher in estimates, especially after the pandemic, than what we had originally estimated. So we are still doing work on that facility, redoing our probation section, updating the treatment space so that we can open that. Then, because of reducing the scope in Fairbanks, we thought it was best to take $4 million of those dollars and move it down to the McLaughlin Youth Facility so that we could fix up that unit that needed plumbing and windows and flooring and all heating and all of the things. And I think you may have seen that unit. So, and we're looking at some other opportunities there. But so Fairbanks is not at full capacity right now because of, number one, we've had the staffing challenges in Fairbanks, but also because we are getting ready to move into that next phase of doing the remodel there. But most of our facilities are at pretty full capacity.
Follow up. So when I toured the facility, they said that there was a time when there was a lot more and they had folks sleeping on the floor. I assume the area that's being redone is where they have sort of where they were like doing court there. That's what part's being redone.
Yes.
But I guess in a broader look of like the past few decades, things are better now, even with the construction phase happening.
Yes, Representative Gray, yes. We've actually seen the numbers of youth coming into services reducing over the years. We're seeing where we're serving more youth in the community. I don't think that the number of youth coming to the attention of DJJ is reducing, but we're really trying to serve youth where they are in the community if we can, in the most least restrictive environment. So we have seen the needs of our facilities reduce over the years.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Wonderful. Thank you, Commissioner Koval and Deputy Commissioner Lasley, for your presentation.
Oh, we weren't done.
Oh, you weren't done? Oh, please continue. There we go.
Okay, just four more bullets. That's it. Okay. For the record, Kim Koval. So quickly, on the future opportunities, we are looking at expanding treatment foster care. This is the result of the Behavioral Health Roadmap and the comp plan, with both concluded the need to expand treatment foster care. And again, as we talked about, like how we're streamlining regulations and whatnot, so we're looking at how we can align those care standards better with the Medicaid requirements and the language. Youth services transformation, we're looking at ways to ensure youth are receiving appropriate services in the least restrictive environments. We are very grateful to the Department of Health and the governor for putting forward the legislation to create a complex care residential home license. Expanding program API, it is truly, API is more than a hospital, and we are looking at it as a division that can offer more programming in the community. We have several outpatient programs that are now operating within our statutory authority at the Anchorage Correctional Unit, at the Highland Women's Correctional Unit, and then also in community with the minor offense folks who have already been out on community. And we are partnering with community agencies on providing those services and ensuring continuity of care. And then finally, we're moving towards centralizing our data to make sure we are making very good policy decisions with quantitative information. For example, our EHR that is now between API and APH, and then also our data lake. And then now we're done.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. Another, I guess, related to the foster care one that I asked before. You're gathering all kinds of data from the services that you provide, the clients you see, and et cetera. How can we reach out more to the community so that the community, not putting anybody at fault, but these are just things that happen, but how can the community help you have less business less people coming your way. It's a good thing when business is dropping off at DFYS and child care services. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. And we need to work on that some more.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Prox. If we want to put ourselves out of business, then we can certainly look at more upstream services and our community partners and how we can support each other, how we are supporting our families in what is best for them by asking what is best for them instead of assuming what we think is best for them. And it really does come back to how we're collaborating, you know, within those different communities and being respectful of what those community needs are. And I think that would be a great first step to putting us out of business.
We'll work on that.
Excellent.
All right.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Now, thank you, Commissioner Koval and Deputy Commissioner Lasley, for your presentation, and to the Department of Family and Community Services for all of the work that you're doing. It's really, really difficult work, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, the time is 4:16 p.m., and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.